Early in Jeffrey Eugenides' new novel, The Marriage Plot, one of the characters says that gender equality was bad for the modern novel. Sexual liberation, divorce, and so on, they all eliminated a major plot device, a device that made the Victorian novel, well, Victorian, and that is whether or not the main characters will get married. Think Pride and Prejudice. But set against this thesis, Eugenides has done precisely what the book says is no longer possible. He's actually written a story that keeps you wondering who the heroine will eventually choose. The book is set in 1982, and it revolves around three characters, all students. There's Madeline Hanna. She's an ambitious and beautiful English major. Mitchell Grammaticus is a Greek-American kid from Detroit who studies religion. And Leonard Bankhead is a brilliant, charismatic, and troubled young science and philosophy student. We meet them just as they're about to graduate from Brown University. And the story begins inside Madeline Hanna's dorm room. Here's Jeffrey Eugenides reading that opening passage.
To start with, look at all the books. There were her Edith Wharton novels, arranged not by title but date of publication. There was the complete modern library set of Henry James, a gift from her father on her 21st birthday. There were the dog-eared paperbacks assigned in her college courses, a lot of Dickens, a smidgen of Trollope, along with good helpings of Austen, George Eliot, and the redoubtable Bronte sisters.
Jeffrey Eugenides, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You started writing this book in the 90s, and I've read that it started out as a completely different story.
I had. It was a different book. It was about a rich family having a debutante party, and all the people were coming home to celebrate the party. And one of the daughters in that family was Madeline. And as I began to write her section, which I had envisaged would only be 3 or 4 pages, I just kept going with her and started writing about semiotics, her boyfriend trouble, and little by little I realized I had another novel on my hands.
Madeline is an English major at Brown, at a time when French literary theory was very trendy, and you paint this picture of these English majors walking around campus with dog-eared copies of Foucault and Barthes and talking about how the 19th century narrative novel is irrelevant. First of all, was that what it was like back in the early 80s? You were a student at Brown at the time, and you studied this.
That was what it was like. French theory, you know, was crashing on American shores in the late 70s and 80s, and a lot of my professors were kind of smitten with it. And you would have two different kinds of professors, the old new critics who were against it, and then the new semioticians. And it was kind of a, you know, battle in the English department. And at Brown, finally, some of the people left the English department and started the Department of Semiotics. It has a new name now, but I was there during those, pitched battles.
Were you skeptical about those theories at the time, or did you sort of assimilate them and embrace them? And
I was a little more of a semiotician than Madeline, not quite as skeptical. I read the theory, as everyone else did, to try to find out what it was about, to make myself feel smarter, to get a more durable critical methodology to apply the literature I was reading. But I also distrusted certain of the statements that the author was dead, that it was impossible to write narrative anymore. I had a more conservative or romantic view of literature, and I've been trying in my career to reconcile both that side, the theoretical side, and I don't know what to call it, but a kind of inborn love of narrative and storytelling.
All three of the characters in this book are very likable in different ways, and I want to ask you about one of them, Mitchell Grammaticus. He is the one, of course, who cannot quite win Madeline's affection, even though her head tells her he's the right one. He seems, at least on the surface, to be pretty autobiographical. He's a Greek-American kid from Detroit. He spends time in India working with Mother Teresa, which you did after college. How much of you is in him or vice versa?
Well, I left out the fact that Mother Teresa and I briefly dated. So if I was actually going to tell the real autobiographical story, it would be somewhat different.
Got it.
But it's true, all of these characters, when you write a novel, you divide yourself into two or three different parts. And each of these people has many of my experiences and many of my thoughts. But on the surface, unquestionably Mitchell Grammaticus resembles me. I could have done things to disguise it, made him blonde, made him Italian or something, but it seemed beside the point. So I plead guilty to a certain amount of that.
The other main character is Leonard Bankhead. He's this brilliant and, of course, troubled philosophy and biology major. He's the one Madeline falls for. Can you read a scene? It's the scene where Madeline tells Leonard she loves him, and Leonard picks up Madeline's copy of the book A Lover's Discourse by Roland Barthes, which talks about the meaninglessness of that expression.
I love you. Je t'aime. I love you. As she read these words, Madeline was flooded with happiness. She glanced up at Leonard, smiling. With his finger, he motioned for her to keep going. The figure refers not to the declaration of love, to the avowal, but to the repeated utterance of the love cry. Suddenly, Madeline's happiness diminished, usurped by the feeling of peril. She wished she weren't naked. She narrowed her shoulders and covered herself with the bedsheet as she obediently read on. Once the first avowal has been made, I love you has no meaning whatever. Leonard, squatting, had a smirk on his face. It was then that Madeline threw the book at his head.
And that scene eventually creates a spiral of circumstances that take us through much of the book. Professor Zipperstein is the one who teaches semiotics, what do you think he would have made of this book if he had his students discuss it? What would he say about it?
Zipperstein would probably not like this book in its entirety. He'd be happy. I mean, you can read this book two ways. You can read it as a deconstruction of the marriage plot and as a postmodern novel, but you can also read it as a traditional realistic novel. So I think he would, if he was in a kind-hearted mood, he might read it as a kind of sly French novel, but it's actually not a sly French novel. It's actually a very sincere American novel.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jeffrey Eugenides. His new novel is called The Marriage Plot. Jeffrey Eugenides, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A number of writers have captured the tenor and flavor of life in contemporary Southern California. Joan Didion, T.C. Boyle, Michael Connelly. Add to them Hector Tobar. Some critics say he's written the definitive book about Los Angeles. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates visited with Tobar recently to talk about the landscape and people who inspired him.
This train's final destination is...
Hector Tobar has just jumped off a sleek commuter train at Union Station in downtown Los Angeles. Across the platform, an older passenger train is just pulling out, the past and the present passing each other. Tobar has a pleasant face with sparkling brown eyes that widen with pleasure when he talks about Los Angeles history. He's doing that now as we enter a metro lobby with murals of LA's evolution.
So the first Spanish settlers who arrive in Los Angeles cross the LA River at the point where it meets the Arroyo Seco, and they come to this spot of land. They find an Indian village of what will later be known as the Gabrielino Indians. And so we're standing really in the oldest corner of Los Angeles. This is the tip of our Manhattan Island. This is our Plymouth Rock.
This, Tobar says, is a city that was built by successive waves of immigrants, which is why he was taken aback when Proposition 187 passed in 1994. The voter initiative, often seen as anti-Latino, denied services to undocumented immigrants. Tobar says 187 showed a mean-spirited side of the state he loves.
And to me, that was really shocking to live in that California, because I had grown up in a California that was a really optimistic place, and it was really accepting of outsiders. It was a place founded by outsiders. Almost everybody here is from someplace else.
187 was overturned a few years later on constitutional grounds, but it became a catalyst for Tobar. Born here of immigrant Guatemalan parents, he wanted to explore the dilemma of undocumented immigrants in fictional form. So he created Araceli Ramirez, the heroine of his novel, The Barbarian Nurseries. She's undocumented, which allowed Tobar to explore the debate about who belongs in California and who doesn't. Araceli is a live-in housekeeper. Tobar is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Yet, he says, they have a lot in common.
She became my alter ego. She's an intellectual in the body of someone who doesn't look like an intellectual, in a position of someone who doesn't look like an intellectual. I'm Guatemalan. My family's Guatemalan. And in the Los Angeles of today, Guatemalan is, for many people, synonymous with servant.
The Barbarian Nurseries has been described as a novel that will redefine Los Angeles, that shows how class affects nearly every aspect of life here. In it, we see the city and its suburbs through Araceli's astute eyes. She works for Maureen and Scott Torres Thompson, an affluent Orange County couple whose upper middle class life implodes when California's economy crashes. The economic meltdown sloshes over into the Torres Thompsons' marriage, as this excerpt shows.
Their fighting was part of a natural rhythm, a kind of release. They could fight, and a day or two later, Araceli would see Scott rubbing his wife's back or Maureen clasping his hand as they watched their children play in the backyard.
But this time there was no reconciliation, and after Scott and Maureen storm off in opposite directions, Araceli is inadvertently left with the care of their two young boys, Brandon and Keenan. The housekeeper decides the children should be delivered to their grandfather for safekeeping. She has a 30-year-old picture with his South Los Angeles address on the back. So, Tobar says, Araceli gets on a train that takes the three of them to Union Station. It's a place she visited when she first slipped into the U.S.
It's her, one of her first places that she sees in Los Angeles, and this is a little bit what she expects Los Angeles to be like.
The station's great waiting room, with its coffered ceilings, Moorish chandeliers, and shining floors, was an elegant welcome to Araceli's new city. But as Tobar points out, his heroine soon discovered this isn't all there is to L.A.
And later she'll, of course, be disappointed because one only has to travel a mile or so from here to be in one of the poorest neighborhoods in the western United States, which is where she eventually will also take Brandon and Keenan in search of their grandfather.
With the boys' parents still AWOL, Araceli shepherds them onto a bus that takes them a few miles away from Union Station. Hector Tobar stands on 35th Street, the same one that's in his book. Down the block, the big factories on the edge of the Garment District loom over small, ragged houses. In the distance, downtown skyscrapers shimmer.
These were rooming houses, apartments that were built in the 1920s and 30s, when this was a place where people from Italy, people from the Ottoman Empire, people from Missouri came to live.
And now it houses the newest wave of immigrants. Like many of their European predecessors, many are undocumented, and they're making a living however they can. Tobar spies a lady walking toward us, tooting her horn as she pushes a loaded shopping cart.
It's something like in Latin America, even in the richest neighborhood, there's a person who comes in, for example, and sharpens the scissors, or a person who comes to sell bread. Each will have his own little announcement of his or her presence. So this lady here, it looks to be selling something. ¿Qué vende, señora? ¿Qué es lo que está vendiendo? ¿Tamales? ¿De qué son?
They're $1 apiece, blisteringly spicy, and as common here as ordering a Big Mac would be across town. With the publication of The Barbarian Nurseries, Hector Tobar has made people like the tamale vendor and, like Araceli Ramirez, visible. Now, having courteously thanked the vendor for her spicy lunch, he waves goodbye and starts back to his workplace near the gleaming towers.
Okay.
Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm David Green. It's rare that we get a look at the inner workings of the U.S. Supreme Court, but retired Justice John Paul Stevens, still active and busy at age 91, has made a few revelations in his new book, Five Chiefs. Stevens dropped by our studios to chat with NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg.
John Paul Stevens, appointed to the Supreme Court by President Gerald Ford, served 35 years before stepping down last year. Retired he may be, but he remains busy, writing, speaking, and on the day I interviewed him, he played both tennis, singles, and contract bridge. Before we turn to his book, I asked Stevens about recent controversies over Supreme Court ethics. The retired justice was always meticulous about recusing himself from any case in which he might even conceivably be seen to have a conflict. So what does he think about the wife of Justice Clarence Thomas engaging in overtly political advocacy?
I'm sure she's acting in good faith, doing what she thinks is in the public interest, and I don't think it has the slightest impact on Clarence's votes on the merits of cases. One might prefer to have her less active, but I really think that's a decision for them to make.
Stevens' book is framed as a discussion about the office of Chief Justice, including a brief history of the 17 Chief Justices who have served over the course of our history, and a more thorough discussion of the 5 chiefs he's known personally. But it's also a book about Stevens' own views. Taking on the much-debated idea of original intent, the retired justice disputes the notion that anyone today can, with total clarity, know exactly what the framers intended. Nor, he argues, should that intent be the be-all and end-all of the legal analysis. He points to the First Amendment freedom of religion guarantee as an example, noting that the leaders of the country in 1789 were all Christian, and their concern was to ensure that no particular brand of Christianity got government preference. Nobody had in mind any other religion.
It wasn't intended to protect the Muslims or the Jewish faith or the atheists. The principle that was adopted is much broader. It's a principle that goes beyond the original intent.
Of the 5 Chief Justices Stevens knew, the 3 he actually served with were Warren Burger, William Rehnquist, and John Roberts. Stevens is not a man with an edge, and he speaks fondly of all 3, going to great lengths to describe Burger as a justice who's unappreciated for the good work he did. But in the end, he concedes that Burger had some unfortunate flaws involving his non-public work as the presiding officer at the court's internal deliberations, known as the conference, among them his frequent failure to understand the positions being advocated by some of the justices, leading to screw-ups in the assignment of who would write an opinion.
He might make assignments to someone who didn't actually have 5 votes for the positions he'd expressed.
Another problem, Stevens says, is that Burger let the discussion ramble on forever. At the beginning of the court term, when the justices would sit down to consider the hundreds of appeals that had built up over the summer, the discussion lasted for nearly 3 days, all day Monday, Tuesday, and part of Wednesday. That changed when William Rehnquist became Chief Justice in 1986, and that same so-called long conference was over on the first day before lunch. Chief Justice John Roberts also gets high marks from Stevens.
He's thoroughly prepared. He's very fair in his statement of the case, and he lets everyone have his say. I think there's a difference between him and Bill Rehnquist in that he allows more discussion after everyone's had a say-so on the case. He's a little less totally efficient.
Stevens blushes when he remembers his first days on the court and his failure on one occasion to carry out the duty of the junior justice. Because only the justices attend the conference, if a message comes from the outside or some papers are delivered that the justice is called for, a messenger knocks on the door and the junior justice is supposed to answer. But at his second or third conference, Stevens was so absorbed in the discussion that he forgot.
It was very embarrassing. Bill Rehnquist sat on my right and Bill Brennan on my left, and both of them got up at the same time to answer, and I realized I had committed a terrible faux pas.
There is, of course, a phone in the conference room, too, that the justices can use to call out, but nobody ever calls in, according to Stevens. Indeed, if the phone rings, it is invariably a wrong number.
Byron White would answer and say, "This is Joe's bar."
Retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. His book is called 5 Chiefs. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Just as unhappy families, at least according to Tolstoy, are unhappy in their own way, so too are economically endangered countries endangered in their own way. That's certainly the impression you are left with after reading Michael Lewis's new book, Boomerang. Lewis visited some of the most financially challenged countries in the world, Iceland, Ireland, Greece, even the United States. And in each case, he found a fatal flaw deeply ingrained in the culture that at least partly explains how they lost their economic way. Michael Lewis joins us now. Good to have you with us, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
So the world in the first decade of this century, as you explain it, was awash in cheap credit. Each country was kind of like it was left in the dark with a big pile of money. And what they did with that money was very revealing about that country. Can you explain that a little more, what you mean by that?
Yes. You can think about the credit bubble as one giant temptation that was laid before the developed world, that anybody who wanted to borrow basically could, in virtually unlimited sums. And given that temptation, different countries wanted to do different things with the money.
So you set off on what you call a sort of financial disaster tour. And the first country you hit is Iceland. And there you say you have a nation of fishermen who thought that overnight they could become a nation of bankers. Now, first of all, what made them think they could do that?
Fishing has been the source of wealth there. And they've used the wealth to buy lots of education. It's a highly educated population. And then you've got a problem. You've got a bunch of highly educated people who are left to fish. And no highly educated person wants to make a living as a fisherman, or very few do. And when all of a sudden their banks were offered unlimited credit by the rest of the world, every young Icelander was offered the opportunity to essentially become an investment banker. And you ask, what made them think they could do this? It's interesting. They developed very quickly a narrative. And the narrative was, Icelanders have a history of taking risk. Icelanders are kind of genetically suited to be investment bankers.
And it turns out that was not necessarily the case.
It was definitely not the case. The losses were just breathtaking. You know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars in banking losses for every man, woman, and child in Iceland. But they basically walked away from most of their debts. So they've kind of gone on their way.
Yeah. And meanwhile, let's go to Ireland now, because the Irish, you say, the famously pessimistic Irish, were discovering optimism. They had an incredible real estate bubble. But as you describe it, this real estate boom had, quote, the flavor of a family lie. What do you mean by that?
Well, in both cases, the banks sunk the country. But the Icelanders' banks did this by essentially handing money to Icelandic tycoons to go buy things overseas. It was a conquering impulse. The Irish, left alone in a dark room with a pile of money, wanted to buy Irish land. And they drove the prices up absurdly. But nobody said it. They all sort of kept mum.
Swept it under the table.
That's right. Mm-hmm. If you think about the Irish history, it's kind of atavistic response. The Irish have always been in less control of their land than most peoples in history. They have had, until recently in history, long experience with nothing but poverty and economic failure.
And as you point out, unlike Iceland, Ireland is going to pay off its debts, and it's going
maybe
to be, well, they're going to try to, or they feel obliged to, let's put it that way.
That's
and it's going
point.
To be tough.
Ireland is the nation on earth that seems most willing to suffer to repay its debts to others. Anybody who's been inside an Irish family can explain this. There's a kind of suspicion of happiness and a respect of suffering. There was a moment right after Lehman Brothers failed when Ireland really could have walked away from its obligations justifiably. It wasn't the Irish government that borrowed all this money. It was private Irish banks. And the Irish government made a decision to basically nationalize this obligation. And the amazing thing is that the Irish people did not protest. The Irish people just said, yeah, we have to pay it back.
Whereas in Greece, of course, protests have been quite common.
Greece is in some way the mirror image of Ireland, because in Ireland, the banks sunk the country. In Greece, the country sunk the banks. The banks in Greece were kind of sober, sleepy, kind of reminiscent of a 1950s American bank. What happened in Greece when the Greek people were left alone in the dark room with a pile of money, what they really wanted to do was bloat the state. It was a kind of piñata filled with goodies that everybody got a crack at. And the Greek state borrowed huge sums of money to do things like, oh, I don't know, run the world's most unprofitable state railroad and pay people huge sums of money not to show up to their job, their government job. I mean, enormous graft and corruption. And every level of Greek society was implicated in this. And yet, when they're told it's time to pay, they're furious. Their response is, we don't want to change. We don't want to pay back the money.
Michael Lewis, his new book is Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World. Good talking to you, Michael. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Writer Paul Hendrickson went to Havana for a lot of reasons. To set foot on forbidden soil, to smoke a real Cohiba cigar, to catch a ride in a vintage Studebaker taxi. But mostly because he wanted to see Ernest Hemingway's famous fishing boat, Pilar.
She was sitting up on concrete blocks, like some old and gasping, browned-out whale, maybe 100 yards from Hemingway's house, under a kind of gigantic carport with a corrugated plastic roof, on what was once his tennis court, just down from the now-drained pool where Ava Gardner had reputedly swum nude. Even in her diminished, dry-docked, parts-plundered state, I knew Pilar would be beautiful, and she was.
Pilar was the one constant in Hemingway's life. Wherever he was in the world, he always came back to his boat and his dreams of chasing giant blue marlin through the Gulf Stream. Hendrickson chronicles the relationship between Hemingway and Pilar in his new book. It's called Hemingway's Boat, Everything He Loved in Life and Lost, 1934 to 1961. And he joins me now, Paul Hendrickson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So there you are. You're standing in front of this old boat, and you describe it in the book as, quote, beached, grime-coated, and time-stunned in the Cuban sun. What about this boat made you think, this is it? This is the fulcrum around which I'm going to write what has never been written about Ernest Hemingway.
Well, it was such a challenge to take on Hemingway in the first place because so many books have been written about him. I knew I did not want to do a, quote, conventional biography. I'm not sure I'm even capable of doing those. Emily Dickinson has a wonderful line that starts a poem, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant." So I think from the beginning, I needed to kind of find a slant way to come at the story of Ernest Hemingway. And many years ago, when I was a Washington Post reporter, I interviewed Hemingway's sons, and each of them talked longingly and lovingly about their father's fishing boat, Pilar. And then at some point later, I read Hemingway's letters, and you see everywhere the mention of Pilar. So one way or another, Rachel, Pilar began to penetrate my consciousness, I guess you could say, as a possible narrative device, a storytelling vehicle. If you can learn everything that happened on that boat, you'll get his entire life.
Hemingway bought this boat in 1934.
Yes.
Where was he in his career at that point?
That's a great question. You could say he was the reigning monarch of American letters. One of the ways to read Ernest Hemingway's life is that he learned everything so quickly and early, and fame came to him so quickly. It is true, Rachel, that by the middle 30s, by the time he got this boat, the critics were beginning some serious sniping, but he was still the reigning monarch of letters. And right at the point he gets this boat, he has just returned from safari in East Africa. And rather than write a novel, he writes a book called Green Hills of Africa, which has wonderful landscape painting in it, but which the critics did not like. And the critics, I think, sort of began to really turn there. You know, a lot of people would say that from the mid-30s on, it was downhill for Ernest Hemingway. I don't see it that way.
What did he want from that boat?
I think he wanted escape. I think he wanted to get away from shore. In fact, I make a case in this book that Pilar helped broaden out, so to speak, his prose line. When you say Ernest Hemingway, what do you think? You think of these simple declarative sentences, these magical and yet very short sentences, free of the subordinate clause. What happens, Rachel, from the mid-30s onward, the Ernest Hemingway sentence gets longer and longer and longer. Why is this? I like to make a case that aboard Pilar, getting away from shore, getting away from the sniping critics, getting away from all the petty little literary games, he can get out there in the Gulf Stream and he can free himself in some way. So Pilar was taking him out there where you don't necessarily see shoreline.
I'm speaking with Paul Hendrickson. His new book is Hemingway's Boat, Everything He Loved in Life and Lost, 1934 to 1961. You talk about these two sides to his personality. I mean, a lot of people who were on that boat, and there were a lot of them, friends and relatives, people who just wanted to be around Hemingway, celebrities. You know, he wasn't such a nice guy a lot of the time, as you point out, but he showed these folks a kinder side of himself. Was that because he was in his sanctuary on the boat?
You know, a boat is kind of a controlled environment, although, you know, he started out as a fly fisherman on trout streams, but he needed a bigger body of water where storms might come up that you cannot control and where fish that are 150 times the size of a beautiful little rainbow trout that he needed to match himself against. Look, he could be everything on that boat. He could be a boor and a bully and an overly competitive jerk, and he could save somebody who was in the water swimming from shark attack on that boat, and he could treat people with uncommon kindness on that boat. He could write achy, generous, uplifting, poetic letters on that boat, and he could write letters that were the absolute opposite. And I think it began to occur to me that someone who could write this beautifully, there must be cores of fundamental decency. Rachel, I had the opposite experience of many biographers. The more I studied him, the more compassionate I began to feel about him. And this will sound possibly naive to your listeners and very unpostmodern, but the more I looked at the life of Ernest Hemingway, the more I felt that here was a man who in some ways wished for sainthood, and not just literary sainthood, and who found a way to defeat himself of that high, lofty aim at nearly every turn. And why? I don't have the answers why. I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of Ernest Hemingway, and this is why we'll keep reading him deep into the 21st century, why he's relevant now.
That's author Paul Hendrickson. His new book is Hemingway's Boat, Everything He Loved in Life and Lost, 1934 to 1961. Paul, thanks so much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.